طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we bring back one of the most articulate and passionate Palestinian advocates who gives expression to the Palestinian narrative every day. Ali Abu Nima is a journalist and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, who conducted this interview from Jordan on a podcast colorfully named Left Bitches Who Are Right, hosted by Anissa Nawe, Ryan Wentz, Amanda Getty, Erica Marabou, and Gregory Haddock. Palestine is rising, resisting and rejecting Israel's racist colonial occupation that's violently subjugated millions since 1948. Will there be justice as long as Western imperialism has its say? Ali Abu Nima parses the bloodthirsty propaganda from corporate media that's been distorting the reality on the ground in the Middle East since day one.
Welcome back to Left Bitches, everyone. We're really lucky to be joined by Ali Abu Nima, the director of the Electronic Intifada and author of One Country and the Battle for Justice in Palestine. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So by now, I'm sure everyone has heard about the atrocities, ongoing atrocities committed by Israel throughout all of Palestine. And I'd just like to first ask you, Ali, can you give a little background as to how this iteration, I guess, of Israeli colonial violence began?
Yeah, well, you know, if you want to start the story, you always have to go back to the beginning, and that would mean going back to 1948 at least, but actually earlier, and I'm not going to do that right now. Basically, it's the same structure that exists. I mean, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, Human Rights Watch declared that Israel commits the crime of apartheid, under international law. And that was news, not because this is a new revelation. It's something Palestinians have been saying for decades, but it was news that such a mainstream organization as Human Rights Watch, which, as you all know, is often in sync with the State Department, particularly on issues like, countries like Venezuela that the U.S. is trying to undermine. Even Human Rights Watch had to acknowledge that Israel practices the crime of apartheid. So that's the basic structure. One group of people, Israeli Jews, maintaining a system by force designed to subjugate Palestinians. And this has been the basic story since the beginning. And Israel is doing this with massive backing from the United States, the European Union, even a number of Arab regimes, and with the most advanced weapons. And because Israel has enjoyed total impunity, particularly in the last few years with the Trump administration, I don't want to give the impression that things were better under Barack Obama, but every administration is worse than the previous one, you know, whether they're Democrat or Republican. So Israel's impunity has reached such a level that it thought it could do what it wants. And so in recent weeks, it has been accelerating the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian neighborhoods in Jerusalem, particularly a neighborhood called Sheikh Jarrah, but also another neighborhood called Silwan, And this is all part of Israel's overall settler colonial plan to convert Jerusalem from a city with a very large indigenous Palestinian population to an exclusively Jewish city, not just demographically, but erasing the culture, erasing the physical presence of Palestinians. Over the last few decades, Israel has forcibly shut down most Palestinian cultural institutions in Jerusalem. They'll arrest you. This has happened if Palestinians try to put on plays in East Jerusalem. They've raided them. They've raided literature festivals in East Jerusalem. So determined has Israel been to Judaize this city, as they call it. So with the growing popular resistance in Sheikh Jarrah, we've seen more confrontation between Palestinians and Israeli occupation forces in Jerusalem. And all of this came to a head over the last week. And on Monday is what Israel calls Jerusalem Day. This is a fake holiday that Israel made up, which celebrate, you know, they Jerusalem Day makes it sound like it's a real thing. Like,
oh, it's like nationalism building 101. Like, that's what you do. You start with a holiday to celebrate yourself, right?
Right. But, you know, it has these fake religious overtones. It's a made-up holiday that celebrates the occupation of East Jerusalem in 1967. So on Jerusalem Day, what has happened in recent years is you get these, and this you can find, you know, at the Electronic Intifada, we've covered this year after year, and we have many videos of it. You won't see it on CNN. I don't think anyone here is old enough to watch CNN, but
back to CNN in a minute.
Right. But, you know, what they do, you have these large organized mobs of ultra-nationalist Israeli Jewish settlers who force their way through the narrow alleys of occupied East Jerusalem of the Old City. They go through the Damascus Gate, which is the sort of, in a way, cultural center of Palestinian East Jerusalem. The Damascus Gate, you know, what it means to me personally is that, you know, my father is from a village that is a few miles outside Jerusalem, and it's a peasant village. You know, people who grew up, it's called Batir, people who grew up doing agriculture, growing vegetables, growing vines. And what they would do, the women typically of Batir, and this is true of all the villages around Jerusalem, they would take their goods, carry them by hand on their heads, and walk to Jerusalem and sell them at Damascus Gate. So Damascus Gate has a very important cultural and economic resonance in Jerusalem. And so they would force their way through Damascus Gate, waving Israeli flags, thousands of them, and they typically chant, you know, it sounds crazy, but it's what they do. They chant death to the Arabs, Mavet la'aravim, and they chant Muhammad is dead, referring to the Prophet Muhammad, and other racist slogans, a lot of racist slogans like that, and they terrorize the people of Jerusalem. This was supposed to happen on Monday, and with what was happening in Sheikh Jarrah, tens of thousands of Palestinians had converged on Jerusalem, including Palestinians from inside Israel, in order to defend the city and to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque from this settler incursion. And what happened Friday, Saturday, and Monday is Israeli forces attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You could see videos of this, of them firing tear gas canisters, stun grenades inside the mosque, one of the holiest, most revered places for Muslims, attacking the women's prayer area, just beating people, beating journalists, medics. They did this big raid on Monday morning, and the intent was to break the spirit of people in Jerusalem, to break the popular resistance so that the settlers could go through and do their display. And one thing I should say, because this is very important context, and why do Palestinians feel they need to defend Al-Aqsa in this way, is that most of the groups that organized this Jerusalem Day display of racism and fanaticism are affiliated with what's called the Temple Movement. And this is a movement that has the explicit goal that it wants to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a Jewish temple. So these are the most fanatical messianic people that you can find anywhere in the world. And they're fully supported by the Israeli government. So what happened in Jerusalem is that they failed to break the resistance, and they had to cancel the settler march, which was a really big humiliation for Israel because they claim they're in control of Jerusalem. And then what happened was in Gaza, which is, you know, maybe if you didn't have the Israeli occupation and the siege and everything, it's like maybe an hour and a half drive from Jerusalem, but it might as well be a million miles away, given how Israel has divided Palestinians up. The resistance factions in Gaza issued an ultimatum, and they said Israeli forces have to withdraw from Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah, and they have to release all the people that were arrested, or we're going to respond. And so that's what happened. The Hamas and the other resistance factions launched rockets at Israel, which didn't kill anyone. Israel then started bombing Gaza, killed a bunch of people, killed now up to this point more than 50 at the last count. And that's where we are as we speak now. And, you know, you do get statements from governments. When I say I'm talking about the Western governments, it's different from other parts of the world. But if you talk about the U.S. and its client states, that either fully support Israel or at best, you know, say both sides have to show restraint, which ignores the dynamic here that we're dealing with an apartheid state versus an occupied people who are resisting and defending their very existence. So that's kind of where we are now.
So what's the regional response then? The sort of neighboring countries, as opposed to the response in the West. What's Iran saying?
Well, you know, the popular response, I mean, I would say that the big divide is between peoples and governments, because like in the United States, there's very little relationship between what people think and what the government says. I don't think that's unique to this part of the world. I'm in Jordan right now. And for example, here in Jordan, for days, there's been a massive demonstrations at the Israeli embassy in Amman, demanding that the embassy be closed, demanding that the ambassador be expelled, and demanding that Jordan cancel its peace treaty with Israel, which is a longstanding and universal demand of Jordanian society. It's incredibly unpopular. And that's been going on despite the fact that there's a curfew because of the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And it's Ramadan. Ramadan just finished tonight. Today was the last day of Ramadan. So that's, you know, typical across the region, that at the popular level, people are absolutely supportive of Palestinians. They support Palestinian resistance. They understand that Palestinians are in an anti-colonial struggle, and people fighting colonial occupation have to fight for their freedom. In no case did people win their freedom from a colonial occupier by writing op-eds in the Washington Post. You know, it all comes down to a material struggle on the ground and international solidarity. So there's strong support in the region. Governments issue statements, but, you know, all of this comes, by the way, you know, within months or within less than a year of the so-called Abraham Accords, which were brokered by the Trump administration between Israel and then certain, you know, Arab dictatorships that are clients of the United States, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, tacitly, but not officially, Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia didn't officially join the Abraham Accords, but it gave its blessing to them, Morocco. And I think that all of those regimes, and some of the sort of the elites and their hangers-on in those countries, thought that they were essentially entering into this marriage with Israel over the dead body of the Palestinian cause. They thought the Palestinian cause was dead, the Palestinians are isolated, Israel is the strong power in the region, and so, you know, we should bet on Israel. And I think these events give the lie to that. They show that the Palestinian cause is alive, the Palestinian people is alive. They have not given up their struggle for liberation. And even more, what you see now is even greater unity of the Palestinian cause, because a key part of Israel's strategy and essential to the Israeli form of apartheid is fragmentation of the Palestinian people. So you have some Palestinians locked up in little enclaves in the West Bank. Then you have 2 million Palestinians caged up in Gaza and completely cut off from the world. Then you have 1.5 million Palestinian citizens of Israel who have a little bit more rights than the rest of the Palestinians, but they're still, you know, fifth-class citizens in Israel. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Palestinians in the diaspora and in refugee camps in the region, and none of them can communicate. None of them can join together. That was Israel's idea. And what do you so I think Israel made a huge miscalculation in thinking that they could do what that they had a free hand in Jerusalem, because the resistance factions in Gaza would never dare respond from Gaza to what Israel was doing in Jerusalem. So it showed that actually there is unity between Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and Jerusalem, unity of struggle. And then even more, you see huge outbreaks of protests and demonstrations, really an uprising for the first time in decades on such a scale among Palestinians within Israel. So what you see is Palestinians struggling and resisting against a colonial regime in every part of Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, and within Israel itself. And that is a pretty significant turn of events, and one I think that, those gloating about the so-called Abraham Accords would not have expected just a few months ago.
Right. What do you think explains the turning out of Palestinians within Israel, and also protests that are kind of erupting all over the world right now? I mean, what explains what's different about the situation today? As you said, it's one of the biggest uproars in decades. What kind of events are overlapping in a sense that's like giving it the opportunity to kind of like get the fire it needs to go?
I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but it is kind of like a pressure cooker in the sense that, you know, Israel's repression, you know, there's always resistance to it. There's always resistance, but it tends to kind of rise and subside in waves. Right. So my first, my first kind of political awakening to all this was when I was a teenager during the First Intifada. I lived in Europe at the time. I was far from Palestine, but the First Intifada, which started in 1987, which began actually in Gaza but quickly spread to the West Bank and lasted for several years. And it was really the broadest and widest Palestinian uprising in many decades. Unexpected at the time. Israel didn't expect it, because they thought that they had this thing, in the bag, that Palestinians were being used as a cheap source of labor. They were being allowed to emigrate to go to the Gulf and earn a living and send money back home. So they thought that they could be mollified, you know, not given any political rights, but, you know, if you let them earn a living, if you let them come to Israel and do, the jobs that Israelis don't want to do, very similar to the way the United States uses migrant labor as a cheap pool of labor, that would be fine. And that uprising broke out. And then that was crushed, and it was actually undermined and betrayed by the the PLO agreement with Israel in 1993, the Oslo Accords. And then I remember being in Palestine in the year 2000 in June. And I remember talking to people then, talking to some of my relatives, talking to people I met, saying, do you think there's going to be another uprising? And people said, no, you know, people are exhausted. People just need to make a living. People just can't go through all that again. And then in September, the Second Intifada broke out.
Hmm.
So, you know, people, the accumulated injustice, the accumulated pain, especially in Gaza, where people have been subjected to 14 years of a brutal Israeli siege. And in a sense, Gaza is the laboratory for the kind of collective punishment that the U.S. uses against other countries, like the sanctions on Iran and Venezuela, which are designed to target the most vulnerable.
Right.
They deprive people of medicine. They deprive them of the ability to travel. You know, I met so many students from Gaza over the years in different parts of the world where the choice is between do you take an educational opportunity abroad where you might be able to get a better education, you might be able to have better prospects, but you won't see your family for 5 years, 6 years, 10 years. You know, you don't know when you'll ever see them again because Gaza is under blockade and you can't freely travel in and out. Or do you stay in Gaza and be with your family? Those are the choices people have to make. And then on top of that, successive wars like the one we're seeing now, the most recent massive war before this one was in 2014, when Israel killed one in every 1,000 people in Gaza in the space of 51 days. So you would not be able to find anyone in Gaza who doesn't know someone who was killed in that war. And, 2,200 people killed in 51 days, 550 children. So that was an average of 11 children a day in the summer of 2014. And that was with bombs provided by the Obama-Biden administration, of course, which I think is important to emphasize because it doesn't change whether you have a Democrat or Republican in the White House. So, you know, I think that we will always see resistance, and there will be moments when things converge, and you get a massive uprising like this. I think the key story is that it takes Israel all the time progressively more force, violence, and repression to try to control this. And you have to think about what the demographics are now. To be generous to Israel, it's 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
Half the population are Israeli Jews and half the population of Palestinians. Of course, there are probably, you know, a few hundred thousand people, if not more, who are neither. But let's just, to simplify things, half are Israeli Jews, half are Palestinians. Actually, Palestinians are probably a majority. And I'm just talking about within Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, before you count the Palestinian refugees. So how long can half the population violently and brutally suppress the other half? And what does it take to do that? That's the basic situation. So this situation now may calm down. We may return to what the media call a relative calm, but it will happen again until Palestinians are free.
Right.
Very well said. Ali, I was going to ask you, you know, being Israel's kind of colonial sibling, could you outline maybe a bit for us, for listeners who don't know, the United States' contributions over the years and now to the erasure of Palestinians?
You know, Barack Obama used to always like to talk about the shared values mm-hmm. between Israel and the United States.
We have an echo with Kamala Harris now, I think.
Right, exactly, yeah. And, you know, what he meant by that was, you know, things like freedom, democracy, and apple pie, of course. But the real shared values are that these are both settler colonial countries. They're built on the expulsion of indigenous people and the construction of a myth that justifies that. So in the case of the United States, we had myths like manifest destiny and independence from Britain in pursuit of freedom, even though that independence came at the expense of the lives and land of millions of indigenous people and millions of people who are enslaved. And Israel is, created by a 19th century European colonial movement called Zionism, which uses Judaism as a cover for its settler colonial ideology. There's this effort by Zionists to blur any distinction between Judaism, a religion, and Zionism, a colonial political ideology. And I think there are, it's not an exact parallel, but I would say there is a very strong Christian nationalism in the United States, which is tied to the flag and guns and, this idea of, Jesus Christ as someone who carries an AR-15 and goes around avenging everyone. And of course, this Jesus is very, very white.
I think that Jesus looks like Greg.
It's probably accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you wearing sandals?
I'm not. I'm in flip flops, but I'm not sure.
That's sandals. That's the 21st century equivalent. Yeah, I think.
Jesus is ripped too. So.
Yeah, that's true. For sure.
It's not exactly equivalent.
Well, you're tall.
But the point is the fact that there are people in the United States who associate Christianity with this ultra-nationalist, white supremacist idea of the United States doesn't mean that that is Christianity.
Right.
There are lots of Christians. We know that that Christianity, that there's liberation theology, that Christianity was an important part in the civil rights struggle. Yeah. So we can talk about Zionism as having a relationship to Judaism the way Christian nationalism, white nationalism in the U.S. has a relation to Christianity. It's obviously not the whole story. But a lot of people buy into it, and a lot of people who don't know a lot think, Israel is the Jewish state, and Jews have suffered so much, so we have to support them. And Israel exploits that to the maximum. And so that is, I think, kind of where there is a strong sort of ideological parallel, and I think also a strong affinity between settler colonial states. So it's not a coincidence at all that, when you look at UN votes routinely in the, on issues of Palestinian rights, you'll have 170 countries voting for a resolution supporting Palestinian rights, the wishy-washy Europeans abstaining. And then, the five countries voting with Israel will be, Australia, Canada, and then, a few countries that are just completely in the pocket of the United States.
Right.
But it's always the settler colonies that band together. And that is ideological. It's not a coincidence.
I'm wondering, you mentioned the situation in Gaza for the last 14 years. It's essentially been an open-air prison where Israel has held 2 million Palestinians captive. I'm wondering if you can get into what the resistance looks like there, because if you're paying attention, just an average American paying attention to the corporate media and the U.S. government, all you hear about is Hamas rockets, and that's how Palestinian resistance is demonized, and that's how they erase
Let me interrupt you. Any pro-Palestinian guest on mainstream media is asked to condemn Hamas. It's the qualification, right? To be able to talk about this in any way, you got to first condemn Hamas. It's like a script. Like, they all have the same script, right?
Yeah, I mean, so to take what's happening right now, Hamas and other groups are firing rockets towards Israel and towards Israeli cities. These rockets can kill people. In fact, they have killed, as I'm speaking, I think 6 people and injured a few others. And so you'll see, for example, the European Union condemn indiscriminate rocket fire. They say this is indiscriminate, therefore it's it should be condemned and it should stop. Well, okay, fair enough. But Palestinians don't have the precision guidance systems that the Europeans and the Americans sell or give to Israel. So
you're not doing it with our toys, so you can't do it at all, right?
And we're not going to give you our toys.
Right.
Israel, on the other hand, has precision guidance weapons and uses them to target civilians.
Right.
As you may have seen in the past couple of days, Israel is targeting high-rise apartment buildings and completely destroying them. So targeting civilian infrastructure. And they've done that throughout. They've always done that. So which is worse, having precision weapons and using them to specifically target civilians, or having weapons that you can't really aim that well and trying to aim them, as Palestinians have also done, at strategic Israeli facilities like, they actually hit a pipeline and a power plant in Ashkelon. They hit the port of Ashdod and so on. But, so you have here an occupied people. And if you were to ask the State Department, go to the State Department, and I think this question has been asked. Okay, so Palestinians have called for a global boycott of Israel, a nonviolent boycott modeled on the boycott that helped end apartheid in South Africa. The U.S. is against that. The European Union is against that. Canada is against that. So, okay, nonviolent boycott is out. That's not allowed. All right. So Thomas Friedman would write op-eds, and Nick Kristof has written this too. If only the Palestinians would have a mass peaceful march like Martin Luther King, the whole world would support them. Well, in March 2018, that's what they did in Gaza. You had the Great March of Return.
Yeah.
Tens, hundreds of thousands of people marched to the boundary to assert their rights, to call for an end to the siege. If you look at the videos of that, it was festive. There were men, women, children. It was a celebration of Palestinians demanding their rights. Israel sent military snipers with Remington rifles to kill them in cold blood and killed hundreds of people. And I don't remember the Nick Kristofs or Tom Friedmans or any of those people demanding that Israel be held to account for that. So nonviolent boycott is out. Nonviolent mass marches, people are going to be gunned down in cold blood and no one is going to say a word. 60 people, unarmed civilians, were murdered by military snipers on the day the U.S. opened its embassy in Jerusalem, while Ivanka Trump and Jared Trump were celebrating in Jerusalem. And nobody said a word. The U.S. opposed any international investigation or accountability. So that's out. So the Palestinians go to the International Criminal Court, a body which is set up, in the wake of World War II and the Nuremberg trials, and to say we want justice for the crimes that have been committed. And by the way, the International Criminal Court, which in December finally agreed to open an investigation into war crimes in Palestine, is investigating Palestinians as well. And Palestinians said, we're okay with that. Investigate us, but we want you to investigate Israel. We want accountability for what's been done to us. Well, guess what? The U.S. is against it. Canada is against it. Germany is against it. So what have we ruled out now? We're not allowed to have a boycott. Nonviolent marches, mass marches, you'll be gunned down in cold blood and no one will say a word. Go to the International Criminal Court, we'll oppose you. So what about military resistance? Of course that's out. So what you see is that this quibbling about the rockets are indiscriminate, they would find any excuse to say there is no form of resistance, none, that we would actually support Palestinians doing. So what they want is for Palestinians to die quietly as Israel takes what's left of their land. And Palestinians aren't going to do that. And like any people in this situation, they'll fight back with the means they have. I'm sure if someone said, well, we're going to give you precision guidance munitions so you can only hit Israeli military bases, Palestinians would say, great. But that's not the situation they're in. And I think it's very easy for people who are, there's a saying in Arabic that the person whose hand is in the fire is not the same as the person whose hand is in water. And I think it's very easy for people outside to lecture Palestinians when they're not in that situation.
Well, and absolutely. I also think there's a massive sort of propaganda machine operating here in the U.S. that's ensuring that people aren't going to question that assessment, right? Like, Greg, can you show some of those headlines that we were talking about earlier? The AP one in particular. Like, if this is the way we talk about it, then obviously this is sort of our edits of it. Can you skip ahead to the AP headline? There it is. There it is. Rockets kill two Israelis. Semicolon, 28 die in Gaza as Israel hits Hamas. What, I mean, with news like this, like, can we be surprised that nobody's asking that question here?
Right, exactly. You know, Palestinians always mysteriously die. What the hell? They just
or buildings spontaneously combust, right? The one, yeah, Greg, can you show the one with the building that exploded, right? With no subject in that grammatical sentence, Gaza tower block explodes as 31 people killed in escalating Israel crisis. It's a crisis for Israel. Gaza tower blocks are exploding. Like,
right.
What is
you
this?
Know, but you know what? I think they actually had to, that took effort. I think someone had to really sit down. It's like, how can we exclude from this headline?
When I'm not hosting this podcast, I am an editor. I head a team of editors. That took work. That took real work.
Yeah, several drafts for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I write headlines every day, and I know that headlines are hard work to get the right headline, you know? So that definitely took effort. Yeah, that's always, I mean, there's always this reversal of reality where Israel becomes the victim. And that's always been the case. You know, I'm old enough to remember how apartheid South Africa was reported. And, you know, in hindsight, people always claim, oh, well, of course, it was obvious that apartheid was evil. But that's not how it was talked about at the time in the 1980s. You know, when I was starting to pay attention to these things, because the U.S. was against sanctions on South Africa. The European countries were against. Britain was against. Mrs. Thatcher. People have all probably seen that episode of The Crown. I remember that. I remember watching that episode of The Crown and thinking, I'm old if I actually can watch this and say, yeah, that's accurate. That's not accurate. That's the way it happened. Yeah, and then like watching these videos on YouTube about what's the real history? It's like, I don't need to watch this. I know it. I remember it.
Just call up Ali. Ali will give you the real history.
Yeah, that's when you start to realize that you're getting up there. But it gives you an advantage that you have the perspective on this. So when it was with apartheid South Africa, there was always this discourse that dehumanized black Africans, that represented white settlers as beleaguered and as under threat, and that, well, yes, apartheid isn't ideal, but you have to understand their fears, you have to understand their vulnerability, that if they give up power, they'll be thrown into the sea. That there was this discourse about, look around Africa, look how much violence there is, look at all these corrupt black dictatorships. Are you going to have like the 50th black dictatorship in South Africa where whites are slaughtered? Those were the kinds of discourses that were used, if not to openly justify apartheid, to try to discredit the case for ending it. And we see similar, I would say it's, we're starting to get to the point, actually. I mean, I feel people are more open to questioning the blanket support for Israel and are less convinced and less ready to buy into these narratives. And that's very heartening. By itself, it's not enough, obviously. But I think it's also important to acknowledge that there are changes because we've been pushing for so many years against these false narratives, against these racist narratives, that people are starting to make the connections. They see the lies that are told about their own context, about what's happening in the United States, and they can start to recognize how these lies are being told about other people. And I think that that is something that, you know, is quite positive.
Absolutely. And what do you attribute that? I mean, I don't want to get too optimistic, but I guess the turning of a tide. I know that the BDS movement has definitely grown in popularity, and do you attribute it to that, or what do you think is the is
what's
behind
driving,
this change?
Well, the main thing I think is resistance on the ground that doesn't allow this to be swept aside. So I would say that the key thing is that Palestinians are still there. They're still struggling and resisting and asserting their existence and their rights. And we who are not in Palestine, who are in the US or in Europe or any other country, have been pushing with the means we have. And my approach is I just say what I think, you know. And I find that with any discourse, you know, that there's sort of, you get these debates among advocates about who are you trying to appeal to? And so that there is a stream of thinking, and I'm probably guilty of this to some extent, or at least a certain point, where you have to appeal to the mainstream. You have to be respectable. You have to make a case that they can identify with. I don't really subscribe to that. At least I don't now, or haven't for some time. I think you have to push at the limits. You have to go further than people are comfortable with, because that's the only way you can actually move things. And, you know, in 2006, I wrote my first book called One Country, Calling for a One-State Solution. And it's not a perfect book, but it was the effort I could do at the time. And it was what I sincerely believed and still believe. But at the time, people were telling me, this is so crazy and it's so far out. What's even the point of doing it? And now, you know, I think it's become completely mainstream to talk about a one-state solution as almost inevitable. And I'm not, I'm not taking credit for that, but I'm saying that you have to be willing to push ideas that people tell you are crazy. And that's how things ultimately change. It's not by simply, if you only say the things that are already acceptable, then nothing moves. That's my philosophy about it. And I've certainly become, I think, more educated and more, can I say this about myself, more radical in a way, in that I have, you know, I've certainly learned from a lot of other people and read more. And as I've read more, understood that the injustice in Palestine, the apartheid in Palestine, is inextricably linked to U.S. imperialism. That there really will be no justice in Palestine as long as there is U.S. imperialism in the region and indeed in the world. So you have to tie those things together. You can't just make a nice, respectable, liberal case for Palestinian rights while being silent about or supporting U.S. empire.
Absolutely.
And that's something that I maybe didn't always believe, or at least didn't think about enough, but it's definitely where I am now.
Well, it's certainly, it's certainly on the forefront of my mind. I have a lot of liberal acquaintances on social media making fools of themselves this week. Contradicting themselves. You can't support one and support the other at the same time. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah. And what role does Israel serve in the U.S. imperial project?
That's a good question. You know, I think that Israel probably less useful than Israel thinks, or it or a lot of other people think. You know, this is going back a few years, but I mean, Israel certainly has acted as sort of an imperial extension of the United States throughout its history. And particularly, for example, in the 1980s in Central America, this is not a story a lot of people know. But when the Reagan administration was supporting the dirty wars in Central America, the genocides of indigenous people in Guatemala and El Salvador and other places, believe it or not, in those days, Congress used to put limits on the power of the executive in foreign policy. So Congress would, you know, stop funding for the Contras, for example, or for death squads in Guatemala or El Salvador. And so the U.S. would ask Israel to step in and do that. And so that's why Israel played a big role in Guatemala in genocides of indigenous people, in training and supporting right-wing militias in Central America. And it's played a similar role in Africa. So there is that. Israel prevents, you know, it has fragmented the Arab world, and various Arab regimes have been kind of bought off and turned into clients of Israel and the United States. But I don't think the U.S. really, you know, there's that famous video, I don't know if you can insert it, from Joe Biden from 1985 or 86 in the Senate, where he says that if Israel did not exist, the United States would have to go out and create
an Israel, right?
I think it's about time we stop, those of us who support, as most of us do, Israel in this body, for apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region.
So maybe that's true, but also U.S. imperialism is pretty powerful without Israel. If you look throughout the Gulf, the U.S. has bases across the region. Its biggest air base in the world, I believe, is in Qatar, but it's had bases in it has a huge naval base in Bahrain. It has had bases in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, across the region. So, you know, the U.S. would not be lost. You know, U.S. imperialism is tied to Israel, but Israel is not necessarily as indispensable to U.S. imperialism as it thinks. And that's why Israel has had to reinvent itself as a tool of U.S. empire several times. During the Cold War, it was obvious. The U.S., Israel, like apartheid South Africa, was basically in the American camp. So there, you know, in the Cold War, it was clear. Following the Cold War, that Israeli utility to the U.S. became less obvious. And so then you had 9/11, and that presented Israel a new opportunity to market itself to American elites and the American public as the outpost of civilization against Islamic barbarism and against al-Qaeda. And that's how Israel very explicitly marketed itself. Of course, the irony is that the United States and Israel then, you know, became allies again with al-Qaeda in the civil war in Syria, with Israel directly arming and funding al-Qaeda-linked groups in Syria, and the Obama administration doing the same through Operation Timber Sycamore. But for a brief period, the U.S., Israel was marketing itself as the antidote. You know, as a former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak put it, as a villa in the jungle. And I think that language tells you everything you need to know.
Totally.
Yeah, I think it's super important for people to understand, for the American public to know, that $10 million of their taxpayer money is going to fund this colonial project in Palestine, whether they like it or not. That needs to be at the forefront of the understanding.
That's what we should be talking about, right? Instead of, you know, virtue signaling on Instagram about supporting Palestinian life.
And people,
well, that's what, yeah, like, and can I just say, since you brought up virtue signaling immediately, that created an association in my head with AOC.
Trigger point, yeah, right.
Is that were you trying to trigger that? And
of it was course, unintentional, but not surprising.
I mean, look, you know, it's nice when we see members of Congress tweeting support for Palestinians. It's better than seeing them tweet support for Israel. That's for sure, but. It's not enough, and we have to say it's not enough. Palestinians have put out a clear call, which is boycott Israel, BDS, boycott, divest, sanction. And Bernie Sanders has not supported the BDS movement. He said he's against it. AOC has not supported the BDS movement. Why are they not at every opportunity saying, boycott apartheid? You know, even Human Rights Watch is saying it's apartheid. Yeah. It's not that big an ask at this point. No, and yet they refuse to do it. So maybe they will, but, you know, we're in a hurry here because it's been 73 years since Palestinians were expelled from their homeland en masse. And, you know, we don't have forever for American liberals and progressives to get with the program. Right, so exactly. People need to keep pushing and not take yes for an answer. You know, don't be satisfied with like a tweet supporting Palestinian rights that is tied to no action and no call for action. And it's funny because I follow, of course, the whole force the vote issue, you know, where we're told on the one hand, oh, there's no point having a symbolic vote on Medicare for all if it's not going to pass. But then when I criticize AOC, I'm told, oh, but she sponsored this bill on Palestinian rights. Well, we know that bill's not going to pass anytime soon. So how come in that case that's sufficient, but we're not going to have a vote on Medicare for all? So there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of excuse making. And I don't think, I'm too old to put up with any of that now. Yeah, so it's like.
Yeah. We appreciate it.
Using millions of human beings whose lives are at risk as a tool for your own political sort of posturing is it's insipid. It's worse. It's the worst. Like, I'm going to say it's the worst.
Because I mean, you know, AOC won a lot of progressive street cred by taking relatively, you know, bold positions on Palestinian rights in 2018 before she was elected. And that was at the time of the Great March of Return when Palestinians were being gunned down by military snipers in cold blood in the Gaza Strip just for protesting for their rights. And then after she was elected, she backtracked. And then recently I wrote about this. I have an article called AOC panders to Israel, I think, or AOC panders to the Israel lobby, but you'd find it easily. Where she is actually now like sort of making nice with extreme pro-Israel lobby groups in New York and even repeating Israeli propaganda talking points. Your very own Ryan is the one who brought this into the wide attention of the public. I heard about her little meeting with that Israel lobby group from Ryan, and then and after that I wrote about it, and then Ryan got visited by the California Highway Patrol.
By thugs at the request of the Capitol Police, who still have not responded to my letter asking for an explanation at Capitol Police. I'm still waiting.
Yeah, so I think that was so important. It was so important to call her out and to keep putting pressure. And none of the, you know, let's remember in 2014 when Israel was slaughtering 11 kids a day during the summer during that summer, Bernie Sanders was angrily silencing his constituents who were asking him about it. And he was defending Israel's right to exist. And Elizabeth Warren was literally running away from questions. There's that video of her on YouTube someone asked her about Gaza and she's like, and runs away. It's like incredible. And now they're making statements that, their positions have shifted, not far enough. But the important thing is any shift has been because of pressure.
Yeah.
And so if you want more shift, you have to have more pressure. And that's the message I hope people take, not just on Palestine, but on everything. These are politicians. You're not going to get anything from them if you spend your time defending them. You know, you have to actually make demands of them and pressure them.
Well, Ali Abunama, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate your time and your insights on all of this. This has been wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunama as he appeared on the podcast Left Bitches Who Are Right. Thank you for joining us this week on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. and again on KKRN.org Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We'll talk again next week.
تسكنوا